It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the changing role of women in the United States military.
But first, Wisconsin's Act 10 is back in court, this time at the state Supreme Court. The law that removed most union rights for many public workers in Wisconsin has faced a number of legal challenges. Now the court will decide whether the law applies to public workers in local governments and schools after a lower court judge ruled that it does not.
WPR reporter Gilman Halstead joins us now to let us know what happened in the opening arguments. Gilman, long time no see.
Nice to be back.
So there's been this tangled labyrinth of court things related to Act 10. What's at stake this time as it hits the Supreme Court?
Well, what's at stake this time has to do just with what Veronica just said. The employees who are in unions who are in cities, towns, and villages, and in schools. And so this is not about the state employees. That was asked a couple of times by justices today about whether what they're looking at right now is a challenge to the way the law affects state employees or just those employees, as I just listed off. And this really does just focus on them, and it focuses on their ability to the requirement that they have recertification elections each year is one of the big ones, big issues at stake here, and whether or not they can take dues from their payroll checks, and whether or not they can, people who don't vote for the union are covered under fair share agreements in which they actually have to pay anyway.
And this worked its way up from a couple local unions' challenges, right?
Right, from the Madison Teachers Union here in Madison and from a local municipal employees union in Milwaukee. And the ruling was made by Dane County Judge Juan Colas that found these provisions unconstitutional.
And there were contempt findings there against people trying to enforce those provisions.
Right. The WERC, which began, as it was called on, by Act 10 to start holding elections in all around the state, in school districts and in municipal employee unions, to actually recertify their union. Now, actually, the Madison Teachers and the Milwaukee Union didn't bother to do that. So, but the fact that Juan Colas said his ruling affected all of these people, he made that really clear. It wasn't just the parties to this suit, the teachers' union and this employees' union in Milwaukee.
So you're in court today. What did you hear?
Well, I heard a very long and complicated arguments, actually. But I heard for the first time Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen actually arguing a case for the state. And he was very forthright, I would say. And he made it clear what we just heard in the story before we came on here, that this does not take away associational rights. He says it's not unconstitutional what Act 10 does, because people who are people can be parts of unions, and they can actually bargain wages. There are a number of things they can't do, but they could do those individually. They could get three people together and go to the boss and say, I think I should get a higher wage. But of course, it's not the same thing as bargaining.
Mm-hmm. Which is covered by some very specific laws.
In which the employer has to listen. But in this case.
Right. And then arguments on the other side, what did you hear?
Well, I heard Lester Pines and an attorney for the Madison Teachers Union, I'm sorry, I can't remember her name right now, arguing that Judge Juan Colas was right, that this does affect all employees, and Lester Pines spent a long time making clear that Act 10 was designed to destroy unions, and that these elections, at least public employee unions, and that these elections in particular actually discourage people from joining unions, because they're unlikely to get a union to represent them, because the election requirements say you have to have a supermajority. Mm-hmm. It's not just a majority of those who vote, but those who are in the bargaining unit.
Now, just briefly, before we let you go, last time Act 10 got to court, it was on a procedural issue, really hotly contested, to say the least, at the court. Are we expecting that kind of controversy within the court this time?
I really doubt it. But it was very clear from listening to the questions that the split in the court is still very much there. Justice Sam Walsh Badley and Chief Justice Shirley Abramson were asking questions in a way that seemed to indicate they might favor the—maybe I shouldn't say this, but might favor the unions in this case, looking for ways that they could win the suit, whereas the other four justices seem to be challenging that in their questions.
All right, Gilman, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date. That was WPR reporter Gilman Halstead.
It's Veterans Day, a day meant to commemorate those who served in the United States military. Just in time for this holiday, the Army unveiled its first statue of a female soldier. The statue is in Fort Lee, Virginia, and it's the first statue of a woman commissioned and placed on a military base.
Later this month, the Senate will debate the annual defense authorization bill. The bill features an amendment from New York Democratic Senator Kristen Gillibrand that would remove the chain of command from the prosecution of major crimes, including sexual assault.
That's one of the issues that women in the armed services face. Right now, we look at the evolution of women's experience in the military.
I want to hear from you. Are you a woman in the military? What's it been like for you? Or are you the family member of a woman who served or a man who served alongside women in the military? Share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org.
Helen Benedict joins us now. She's a professor of journalism at Columbia University and the author of the book The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq, also the Iraq War novel called Sand Queen. Helen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're credited with breaking the story about the epidemic of sexual assaults of women serving in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. How much has changed for women in the military since then?
Not a lot. There have been changes in the laws regarding what happens when they report, and there have been changes in supplying sexual assault counselors. So that's at least encouraging women to report more, and I think the new leap that was just reported this past week, the huge leap in numbers of sexual assaults reported, is at least partly due to more women being able to report than before, because traditionally it's been something like between 80 and 86% of assaults have not been reported. But the problem still exists, and it still exists in enormous and frightening numbers. It is still a occupational hazard for a woman in the military to deal with harassment and worse from many of her or some of her comrades, and that is alarming and shouldn't be.
Well, you've said in the past that women in the military are serving two wars. They're in a war against the normal dangers that one occurs with enemy combatants, and they're also serving a war against the people they're supposed to be able to trust. That's a devastating thing to say. Do you still think that's true?
Yes, I think it is. And I don't want to be too general here, and certainly don't want to sound as if I'm saying that all men in the military are treating women like objects of prey, because that's not true. But it's so common. I mean, the statistics are still something like 30% of women are sexually assaulted by comrades while serving. That's almost one in three. So it's a hostile work environment. And unlike the office, you can't go home. You have to live with the people who are treating you like this 24 hours a day for month after month after month. Often the people who are harassing or assaulting you are also above you in the chain of command, so they have complete control. As one of the soldiers told me, they control when I eat, when I sleep, when I work, when I don't work, when I can call home, when I can't call home. They have complete control over my life, and I'm supposed to do everything they tell me to do. So that's a much more dire circumstance than anybody faces in a civilian office.
In the intro, just a moment ago, we mentioned New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's amendment to the defense authorization bill that would change the way sexual assault is prosecuted, take it out of the chain of command. Can you tell us more about that amendment and what you expect to happen?
Yes. I mean, what these studies have shown, studies done by the Defense Department itself, is that the way it's been traditionally and still is now, when you report an assault, it has to be reported to the commander of your unit. It has to go up the chain of command that you belong in, which means that if you wish to remain anonymous, firstly, that's almost impossible because these are small, gossipy organizations, platoons and units. And secondly, it's been found that very often the person you're reporting to either knows the accused or is the accused. So you can have this absurd situation of reporting your rape to the rapist. According to the documentary The Invisible War, that happens in 25% of the cases. So how can there be military justice when the person who's in charge of deciding whether to investigate and prosecute is trying to protect his own reputation or his own friends? What Gillibrand wants to do is take that decision completely out of the chain of command to an impartial body who won't have any investment in protecting themselves, so there won't be a conflict of interest.
Now, it's looking as though that could be a tough fight for that amendment, and it has some staunch opponents, opponents who say that you need the chain of command to make the military work. It's, the whole system is sort of predicated on people believing in the chain of command. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that it hasn't worked. I mean, that's how it's been all this time, and there's this huge amount of evidence that only a small percentage of these cases get investigated, or let alone reach conviction, and that only a small percentage of those who are convicted actually get booted out of the military. So it hasn't worked. Also, a lot of our NATO allies have been using Gillibrand's method for a long time, including Canada, Britain, and several other countries. I mean, in Canada, they've been taking the investigations of sexual assaults out of the military for 20 years, and no generals are complaining there that it undermines their credibility. You have the way it works now is it makes a mockery of the term military justice. You can't have people investigating themselves when they're the criminals, or when they're friends with the criminals, or when they're invested in protecting the criminals. It's just glaringly irrational.
Now, you've spent a lot of your recent career talking to women veterans, talking to women who serve. What have they been telling you about their experience? What struck you?
The first woman I ever met, first woman veteran I ever met, I came up to her and I said, are you a veteran? And she was 21 years old and she said, yes, I've been just come back from Iraq. I was there for 11 months and I was a gunner. But when I talk about it, nobody believes me because I'm a female. And I said, well, I'll listen and I believe you were doing it. What happened? And she said, well, the first thing you have to understand is that if you're a girl in the military, the guys only let you be three things: a bitch, a whore, or a dyke. You're a bitch if you won't sleep with them, you're a whore if you've got one boyfriend, and you're a dyke if they don't like you, so you can't win. And I was so shocked at that I had to look around and find out whether this was just her or whether it was true. So I spent the next 3 years interviewing some 40 women who'd served in Iraq, and I also went deep into the databases of the Department of Veterans Affairs and found that they'd been studying sexual assault in the military since Vietnam, and that's where I found these terrifying statistics, over 30% statistics, and since then more and more has come out about it. And I still talk to women today who they bring up the bitch, dyke, whore line all the time. I mean, they say, oh, yes, that's exactly what it's like. That's exactly what it's like for too many of us. Again, not everybody, but too many. It shouldn't be like that for anyone.
We're talking right now with Helen Benedict. She's a professor of journalism at Columbia University, the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq.
And we want to hear from you. If you're a woman who is serving or has served in the military, call and tell us your experience. Does it sound like what our guest is talking about? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you're a man in the service, have you served alongside women? What was that like? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickard. Our guest is Helen Benedict. She's a professor of journalism at Columbia University and the author of the book The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. And we're taking your calls now.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe as a woman serving in the U.S. military. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or a family member, a daughter, sister, mother who served in the U.S. military. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
Now, Helen, your book is called The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. Why is the war private for them?
That refers to the fact that so many women have felt that they can't tell anybody about harassment and rape if that's what's happening to them. The culture in the military for everyone is to not complain, especially not to complain about each other. You're seen as a traitor, as letting the side down. And when it comes to sexual assault, it's also a victim-blaming culture, as is our world in civilian life. You must have brought it on yourself by being careless or being flirtatious or drinking too much or being a weak soldier for failing to defend yourself and protect yourself. So the message everywhere is to keep quiet. And I asked women, you know, how they felt, if they felt safe, or rather nobody feels safe in war, I'll take that back, but I mean, if they felt they could trust their comrades to watch their backs in battles, if they were in one of those platoons where they were being constantly harassed or even attacked, how can you trust your comrades to keep you safe? And they said, we can't, we feel alone. So I kept hearing that phrase about being alone, which is why I called it the lonely soldier. And the silence is why I used the word private.
Now, we just heard the story this morning that there is the first statue of a woman soldier. She's dressed in her army fatigues, and she's carrying an M4 rifle, I think it is, in the statue in Virginia on a military base. Do you think that, you know, maybe this and that there are other signs that the military is in good faith and wanting to improve things for women going forward?
I think the statue is a great step forward. All the other statues of women have shown them as nurses or that kind of role rather than as fighters. And women have been on the front lines since the beginning of the Afghanistan war, because there are no front lines in wars like this. Women get drawn into being gunners and even raiding houses because they're working alongside the infantry, often in combat support. And, you know, bombs and attacks don't choose who's supposedly an infantry person and who isn't. So long before the combat ban was lifted, women were really fighting in this. And yet, that because of the ban and because of the traditionally misogynist attitude that's gone on for generations and generations, women were very much second-class citizens in the military. And I think a statue like this recognizes them as equals and shows respect for them. And that is the most important step towards treating them equally in every other way.
Now, given all the women that you've spoken to and the problems that you just described, what do they say and what do you think needs to happen in the military to make things safe and supportive and to create the kind of environment where women can really contribute and feel like they're giving their whole selves and being respected in the military?
Well, fairness of promotion, banning the language that's often used by drill sergeants and among just among soldiers in general or any of the branches, which is there's an awful lot of derogatory language about women that's just used in casual talk or that drill sergeants, drill instructors will use to dress down their soldiers. They'll even scream, "What are you, girls?" and other more vulgar words as if just being female is somehow is demeaning you. So there has to be more respect throughout and it has to be genuine. But there really has to be consequences, too, to when there is wrongdoing. You know, and that's what this new bill is addressing, and that's what Congress has got is trying to address. The defensiveness has to end. The self-protectiveness of the old guard against, which has been stalling about changes when it comes to treating women and ending discrimination against women in all kinds of ways, not only in terms of sexual violence. I mean, it should be, I would love us too, even the media, to pay more attention to what women have achieved as well as not only talking about them as victims, because of course they're not. I mean, I have met so many women who have saved lives and have worked very hard to help the civilians of Iraq or Afghanistan, even if they are at the same time being harassed or even assaulted. that they're it's doubly heroic, and those who've had the courage to speak out as well are triply heroic. It's very hard to speak out from an organization like the military. But when you use the word respect, that is the most important key. Our women are equal in every way, and it's time to face that, both in the military and in our civilian life at large.
Well, Helen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Helen Benedict, professor of journalism at Columbia and the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq.
Coming up next, we're talking about The Book of Men. It's a collection of 80 stories trying to answer the question, what does it mean to be a man?
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the issues that veterans face upon deployment and reentry into civilian life.
Now, though, we're going to take a look at what it means to be a man.
To help launch a new literary nonprofit called Narrative 4, Esquire magazine asked 80 of the world's greatest writers to contribute a story about what manhood means.
The contributors include Salman Rushdie, Terry Tempest Williams, and Jeff Dyer, to name a handful, and they take a hard look at the ins and outs and the ups and downs of masculinity today.
Our next guest curated the work called The Book of Men and is a co-founder of the group Narrative 4. Colin McCann is the National Book Award-winning author of Let the Great World Spin. His most recent book is Transatlantic. Colin, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Before we get to these stories, talk about Narrative 4. What's the goal of the organization? What are you trying to do there?
We set up Narrative 4 about a year ago. And basically what we're trying to do is take kids from all over the world, say from Belfast, from Haifa, from Detroit, from Chicago, from Madison, from New York, wherever, New Orleans, and we bring them together to exchange one another's stories, not just to tell one another's stories, but to literally step into one another's shoes. We call it radical empathy. And what happens is that you get these kids from all over who take responsibility for somebody else's life. And we find that it's an incredible way to learn to tell somebody else's story and give your own story to another person in order for them to tell it back. And it has extraordinary implications for empathy, for decency, for community. And so we're hoping to set up this. We're doing a lot of work between Chicago and Limerick, also between Chicago and Newtown, Connecticut. The kids in Newtown, Connecticut, who experienced that terrible massacre last December, are exchanging stories with kids from the south side of Chicago who sort of see violence on an everyday basis. And they learn then to what it means to be somebody else, and that I suppose you'd say that the world has big lungs. It's a great organization, I think.
Well, for this book, How to Be a Man, you compiled 80 stories, you curated these, and these are all about manhood. Why do you think men need something like this?
Well, to be totally honest with you, we were helped out by Esquire magazine, and the issue in which we were going to publish the essays was the Father's Day issue. And they said, you know, it'd be great if we could get these writers talking about what it means to be a man. But then it started to trill sort of deeper into the notions of, you know, who these kids are. And you know, like if you have kids, say, from a working class area of Limerick, trying to figure out what it means to be a man, so much of what supposedly a man is about can be about violence and can be about loss and can be about things being taken away. And we're much more interested in, the notion that how to be a man is deeper and more complex than all of that. I should tell you that we are definitely going to work on a version called How to Be a Woman.
So It's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that tell us how to be men, in this case, and women for the sequel. TV, ads, our peer group. Why? This is mainly fiction. Why fiction as a road to learning about manhood, about masculinity?
Well, that's a great question, because the thing is that fiction is a tool in which can embrace all sorts of contradictions. It can get at the notion of manhood allegorically. It can get at the notion of manhood with sort of suggestions. And it can hold complicated notions at the same time, different notions at the same time. So I think fiction has a strength and a complexity that nonfiction doesn't necessarily have. I mean, nonfiction, you hammer in the nail and you hit the nail on the head. With fiction, you tend to groove the wood so that it all fits together. It's a different process. It's a more suggestive and possibly a more generous process than pure nonfiction.
Now, one that you're particularly interested in is by the actor Gabriel Byrne. I think you said it was his first published work. What can you tell us about that piece?
This was so much fun. So we have all sorts of people from all over the world, writers from all over the world who are interested in narrative four. I mean, we have Salman Rushdie, as you said. We have Mona Simpson, Terry Tempest Williams, Ian McEwan, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. We have, and people from all backgrounds. And I'm friends with Gabriel Byrne, who your listeners will know. It was in The Usual Suspects, and he sends many a heart a-fluttering with his appearances in Treatment. And I was talking to Gabriel, and he's a great writer. He's a really great writer. And I said, Gabriel, would you do us a story for the anthology? And he has written lots of nonfiction before, but he'd never written fiction or a short story. And so he came along, and he wrote this wonderful, evocative piece about Cold War Ireland and growing up in Dublin and what it meant to be a man when the character in the story is a young boy who's looking in a shop window at the images of Khrushchev and Kennedy flickering on the screen.
Do you want to read us a little bit?
Sure. I can read the whole thing if you want to, because...
It's pretty short,
It really is very short and very... It's kind of like a poem.
Excellent.
So this is How to Be a Man by Gabriel Byrne. In the shop window, Khrushchev and Kennedy flickered, white and black, on a 17-inch pie television screen. It was yours for 10 shillings and 6 pence per week on the Never Never Misses. It was an electrical shop and a gentleman's outfitters, carnies, all windows, no walls. The leaders of the world sat right there, voiceless to me, behind the glass, among sports coats and hoovers and transistor radios. And Ned, the postman, who read lips on account of his eldest being deaf, shuffled up beside me, smelling of woodbine. The rain came down, no surprise. Ned narrated to me a fearful language never heard before, death and hell, rivers on fire, hills of molten lava snaking along the streets. We will bury you. The flesh was falling from the bones of those I loved, and all the mountain flowers were crushed and broken. All the next day, the rain kept falling, falling, and out over the fields, my grandfather and I tramped to bring home, in their sodden innocence, the beasts of the field for milking. The dark angels screeched for worms in the new-turned earth, and I, yesterday a boy, made man now by knowledge that presently all must end forever, stood beneath the drip-dropping branches while my grandfather drew the smoke of his cigarette deep down into himself and let it out. And for a moment, the smoke was one with the breath of cattle. And in that moment, young and old were speaking in an ancient silence, understanding nothing, everything, and all the world was made eternal.
That's Colin McCann reading from the Book of Men. That's Gabriel Byrne's contribution Oh, what was that line? Yesterday a boy made man now by knowledge that presently all must end forever. An interesting thought. Can you expand upon that? What do you make of that as part of what it means to be a man?
Well, I think, what Gabe was talking about is that moment when you realize the world is beyond the confines of your, that little town or village that you grew up in. You're standing there, you're outside the television shop, and then suddenly you see Khrushchev, and you see Kennedy, and you hear all of the, these things are voiceless to him. But he's learning that the world is getting big.
Well, it seems like a sense of burden and maybe even responsibility settling in on you there, too.
That's right. I can feel that... That responsibility. That suddenly the world is growing for him. Suddenly the world is getting bigger. And for someone like Gabriel, that's opening up. He opens up as an actor all the time, obviously. But here he is sort of in his own voice and in his own body. It's a hard thing to write a piece of fiction like that, particularly one that's as beautiful as that.
Do you think, that this book might speak to, to everybody, but I guess particularly to men right now, because, there's been a lot written about how there aren't the old rituals anymore. They're kind of breaking down, and you don't really know when you become a man or a grown up anymore. And maybe what we just have is stories to tell us that everyone has something else, and maybe yours is just as valid.
Yeah, well, I think, the world is... I've always said that the greatest democracy that we have is the ability to tell our stories. It goes across borders, it goes across boundaries, all sorts of genders, all sorts of issues. The stories are big, and lots of things can happen to us in our lives, and we can have things taken away from us. We can have our houses taken away from us. We can have our cars taken away from us. We can have loved ones taken away from us. We can even have countries taken away from us. But we can never, ever, ever have our stories taken away from us. That, to me, is profound. And I think that young men in particular need to know that they are valuable and that their stories are valuable. Because so much of what culture is about today is like dismissing, whole swaths of the population by pretending that they don't matter. And what we're saying with Narrative 4... And also what we're hopefully saying with the Book of Men is that, no, hold on a second here. No, you matter, and what you have to say matters. And you can legislate the world, and you can operate in it and change it, hopefully.
We're speaking right now with Colin McCann. He's the curator of the collection The Book of Men and the author of the book Transatlantic.
We'd like to hear your thoughts. Do you have a story about what manhood means to you? Do you think it's changed in your lifetime? Is there a book or a novel or a story you've read that tells us something about what it means to be a man? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time.
We're speaking with Colin McCann right now. He's a contributing editor at Esquire, co-founder of Narrative 4. And we're talking about a recently curated work of 80 stories about manhood. It's called The Book of Men.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there an author, a book, a story that affects what you think of manhood, of being a man? You can call if you're a man or a woman, by the way. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. It's 800-642-1234, or share on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to the phones now. We have Michael with us in Madison. Michael, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. Do you have a thought to share with us?
Yeah, so really what comes to my mind is the kind of really masculine way of thinking that men, can't really show emotion. I've read Hemingway comes to mind, that war brazened man who can't show emotion. That sort of seems to be a value in our culture today. That's what I feel.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. So that's one of many fictional elements, column inspirations of manhood. What do you make of what he had to say?
Yeah, I think he's right, and I think it's part of our problem. You know, the difficulty that so many of us have in learning to express our emotions or our deepest, you know, dark down feelings. If we can get to them, and if we can be honest with ourselves, and then possibly learn to be more honest with each other, I do think that you know, we could be on a path to deeper empathy. And really, I mean, empathy is a key word here. It's what we need so much more of. And I think, personally, that the biggest political failure that we have nowadays is a failure of empathy, a failure to understand what it means to be poor, a failure to understand what it means to be, you know, in another country or of another religion or of another, you know, viewpoint. If we could sort of be more muscular with our empathy, then I think we'd be in a far, far better place. And of course, Barack Obama has talked about this in his own work, in his own writing, in relation to empathy. And but I do think that if we had more ability to embrace our emotions, we'd probably be better off.
It's so interesting to hear you say. I mean, we can't legislate empathy. It's something you have to feel. And, you know, I guess fiction and writing in general is one way to feel things.
Exactly. You cannot legislate it whatsoever. But we have to stand up and say, you know, this is my story. Please, you know, listen to me. And I will tell your story. I will respect you. I have to tell you, when we get these kids together, we got kids together from Chicago public schools, because a lot of our test work is going on in Chicago, and they started to tell one another stories. The world was immediately changed for them, and they went out of there better citizens, more prepared to deal with the world around them, more prepared to tell the truth about, you know, themselves. And we've also begun it with these kids in Limerick, as I said earlier. And eventually we will have kids from, you know, from Haifa, in from Israel, you know, exchanging with kids from New Orleans. And if we can do that sort of thing, we begin to look at each other in a more powerful way and own one another's stories, I think, you know, we'll change the world in little but significant ways.
All right, we've got another caller, David, with us in Madison. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Great, great, great discussion. I stumbled into this topic, and I just caught the tail end of your show, but I stumbled into this topic as a man in nursing. Growing up, I didn't have a whole lot of male men in nursing as role models or anything, but I started seeing how I was treated differently by patients and colleagues when they perceived me as a physician first, but then changed. And when I told them that I'm a man in nursing, the respect and things like that changed literally in an instant. But as I just started to research that topic and look into matters on my own, it seemed like bullying was something that was a common factor in how men developed, and just that constant posturing of proving one's manhood. So when I heard the topic today, I always kind of cringe and think, all right, are we going to go with a man-up approach, be more masculine, be more tough, hide your emotions? But to hear your guests say, no, let's celebrate empathy amongst men, and let's embrace that, let's welcome it, just warms my heart, because I truly don't think men can really get to their fullest potential without getting into those gray parts of life.
Gotcha. And thanks, David. I want to get a response from Colm. He worried that empathy is bullied out of men or postured out of men. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what David had to say is really, really, really profound and interesting to me. Because what happens is so much of this comes down to language and the difference between the language of calling somebody a nurse and a physician. You know, both are there saving lives, but we have these sort of hijacked perceptions in relation to one word, and then we have other perceptions in relation to the other. And really what we have to be doing is to try and break down those barriers, and this all comes down to language, which is at the root of everything, and it's how we tell our stories and how we tell other people's stories, and that's to me, you know, one of the things that we absolutely must work on if we're going to keep progressing. You know, I think everybody would agree that we want the world to keep progressing. We'd like it to be a nicer place to live in, a better place to live in, a better sort of planet. Well, we have to keep, you know, examining issues of language.
Well, thank you to David for that call, and let's go next to William in Ellsworth. Hi, William.
Hi there. My grandfather taught me that I always kind of worried about my self-image, that I wasn't, you know, as strong as the other boys. You know, I always worked on trying to build my muscles and everything, but he really showed me that it's not, you know, how strong I can be, but it's the love that I can show to other people. You know, it's not just, you know, physical image, but it's how I treat others. So that makes you a man, you know? And yeah, so that's all I really wanted to say. You know, you just taught me that even if I was, you know, a little skinnier, if I was, you know, scrawny, had glasses or bifocals or trifocals, binoculars or contacts, it didn't really matter, you know?
It sounds like that was a lesson that's really stayed with you, William. Thank you so much for calling. And Colm, what do you think about the passing on of so sort of deeper truths from one generation of men to the next? Is that important?
Yeah, I think, some of them can be good and some of them can be bad. Obviously, the caller's, grandfather passed on some sort of deep knowledge. And that was fantastic. And what's interesting to me about what's going on with us is that, you know, some people say, well, it's sentimental to talk about that sort of thing. I don't think it's sentimental to stand up and want a better world, for instance. I think it's full of sentiment, yes, but it's not sentimental. I think there's a big difference between being sentimental and having proper sentiment. And part of the proper sentiment for all of us is decency and, like, looking after one another and, you know, and standing up and saying enough of this bullying, enough of this, you know, pushing around, and give a voice to what was sort of previously voiceless.
All right, Colm, thank you so much for joining us. Interesting conversation.
Thank you so much.
That was Colm McCann. He's author of Transatlantic, curator of the book we've been talking about, The Book of Men, and he's also co-founder of Narrative 4, and I'm interested in some follow-up on that in the future, I think.
Coming up, we'll look at the issues facing veterans when they return to civilian life. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.